All right, welcome y'all to another episode of Strength Academy. I think we're on episode number 17 now. This is Mundo, once again joined by Grayson.
How's it going, everybody? Sorry for the little hiatus last week, and apologies for any coughs and sniffles that you might get throughout this podcast today. We're just trying to stay healthy here as it starts to get a little bit colder. We got our first snow today, which means we'll hopefully not be horribly on fire next year as long as we can pack in a little bit of snow this winter.
No, this isn't the first time it snowed. It snowed a few weeks back. That's didn't stay very long. It never really does here.
Yeah, I guess I really only count it if it sticks to the ground past 10 in the morning. That's when I count it as it snowed.
Oh, okay.
But it's really just the grass gets a nice dusting.
Yeah.
But we'll hopefully be able to catch some serious Midwestern snow this weekend as we head out to the American Open Finals. We'll be leaving here. I think we're both leaving Thursday, right?
Yeah, I leave Thursday morning, and I think the rest of the team does on Thursday throughout the day as well.
So we've got, we'll be heading out to Milwaukee, and we've got five athletes headed out there. So we'll have a nice full weekend. We've got two on Friday, one on Saturday, and then two on Sunday to wrap things up. So we got a nice dispersal all weekend. I checked the weather. We got highs in the 20s, and it'll be a nice change of scenery, hopefully, and a good competition overall.
Yeah, it should be. A lot of the people that I wanted to see had already competed at Worlds, and there's a few people that are going to be competing at American Open Finals that are going to be fun to watch. I think one of them, for me, was John Downey in that session with Rob Blackwell. And there's a couple other ones in the lower weight classes for the women as well. I know Megan Seeger's going to compete. And, yeah, here and there, there's going to be some good lifting. Like I said, but for me, most of the lifts that I wanted to see take place have already been done at Worlds.
I think one of the things that I'm kind of excited to see in that same session you were talking about with John Downey and Tom Suma and Rob Blackwell is Jared Fleming's on the start list. And I have been under the impression that he was like retiring from both weightlifting and CrossFit, but he's on that start list, so he's got to be feeling okay. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what he's lifting after his time off, because I believe at the time that he suffered that injury at Worlds 2015.
Think so, yeah.
He had that ACL tear, and I mean, at the time he briefly held the American record snatch at 170, did he not? So it'll be interesting to see what kind of shape he's in down a weight category from 94 to 89, and after a couple years of CrossFit, it'll be cool to see what he pulls out. He was always a lot of fun to watch, though. Super amped up, very excited.
Yeah, that was when Muscle Driver was still around.
Yeah, yep, that was still when, that whole thing. Yeah, there was a lot of good lifting coming out of there for a while.
Right.
So that'll be exciting to see. I'm personally looking forward to see how Kate Vibert does, or whatever her last name is now. I think she just got married. And most of all, I'm just excited to be bringing our athletes out there. Almost everybody's in the B session this year, so that's good. We're moving people up steadily, getting out of the D sessions and moving up closer and closer. And that's as it stands now. We might have some changes to final entry, but I think everybody's looking pretty good. We're going to be doing essentially our last heavy snatches on Monday, and then some just dwindling down on that taper week and trying to keep everyone healthy and mobile on the plane and just getting them out there and having them put in good work. But I think it'll be a good showing for us. Five is a record for us, bringing people out to the American Open. I think we had four last year and three the year before that. So we're nice and steady, kind of bringing some people up. And yeah, it's gonna be a really good time. unfortunately, as anybody listening who has traveled to these kind of meets before, you don't really get to do a whole lot of sightseeing. It's a whole lot of hanging out in the hotel ballroom, but it's good to get out there and kind of get to try to network a little bit and talk to other coaches or lifters that you don't get to see very often, and having some in-person interactions is always better than trying to DM somebody on Instagram or something if you think you can have an interesting conversation.
Yeah, that's true. And I think part of it is, for a lot of people, this is not a vacation. Like, we're not going to Milwaukee for, you know, to have a good time. Even though people might see it that way, it's like, oh, you're going out of town, it's a vacation. No, really it's not. We're going to be having lifters pretty much every day of the competition. And some of them are going to be early, some of them are going to be later. So it's not like we're going to have a whole day where it's just down to do, you know, whatever we want. Not that there's a whole lot of stuff to do in Milwaukee for hopefully people that don't want to be outside. I don't know. I've never been there, so.
Yeah, hopefully there's some good food, though. You know, everywhere we go, I always try to, you know, find some sort of meal to have that is better. I always appreciate trying to find good restaurants. And that was one of the disappointing things in Vegas, was that we were so busy that we never really got to go to any, you know, high-end, kind of nicer restaurants. It was just sub sandwiches in the hotel lobby.
Yeah, a lot of the time. Yeah, the hotel food, and then pretty much anything that people were willing to bring us, you know, throughout the day. So we didn't really get to sit down anywhere and have, like, a nice meal. Yeah, we were on the go almost the entire time.
As always, one of the hardest things to do getting ready for meets is just being on top of weight cutting. And this year, it's interesting because Robin and Tyler's schedules have sort of flipped, where Robin's used to weighing in first thing in the morning, and that's usually when she's been lifting in competitions, and Tyler's used to kind of being later in the afternoon, and I think he's earlier this year. So this will be one of the first times he actually has to wake up at weight versus waking up and then going to sauna.
Yeah.
And then Robin's in the exact opposite boat because she's used to having to cut the night before and then, you know, just go and lift in the morning. But now she's got to wait until 1 in the afternoon. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see, you know, these guys process new challenges in that, you know, that change of what you're used to. And then, you know, Consuelo coming out for her first American Open finals. And Riley as well, right? This will be his first finals.
Yes, it'll be Riley's first as well.
Yeah, so two first-time entries to this one. So just making sure that they get out there and make weight and let us handle all the planning. And they just have to be there at the right time with their weightlifting shoes. Yeah. And
make some lifts.
Yeah, make some lifts. It's going to be a really good time.
Yeah, it'll be good. I think the venue is pretty close to, like, downtown Milwaukee. So there should be a lot of cool stuff to do, like, in that area. But, like I said, a lot of our weightlifters are spread out throughout the weekend, and we don't really have a single day where we don't have nobody, or we don't have somebody that's competing. And excuse me. And when you have athletes spread out like that, you know, some of them are cutting weight, so you can't always take everybody to go do something. Or if they do go, you know, they're still miserable trying to make sure that, you know, they're staying underweight and on track to make their way in. So that's kind of like, that's another reason it's not really a vacation, not really for anybody until after you've lifted, or if you were going to stay there longer.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in an ideal world, you know, if we had limitless free time, it would be cool to get to spend an extra few days in all these places we get to go. But, you know, we get what we can. We see a couple sites, but it's all the lifting, you know. Yeah. It's what we do. The goal is to get, you know, people competing at these meets and doing well. I think everybody's in good shape. We've had you know, some PRs out of a few people. We've had just really good, consistent performances. So I'm excited to see everybody put it together on the platform for sure. Yeah. I think, at least I think they'll be on a platform. So one of the ideas that I kind of wanted to spitball about a little bit this week is we were kind of talking about the Stoics and skepticism on the last couple of podcasts. And one thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is the idea of, like, how do you know what's true? And I know that the Stoics kind of had this idea that there were degrees of certainty you could have or impressions of things. Versus the skeptics who just kind of threw that all out and said, you can't possibly know anything.
Right.
And what I liked about this conversation is that it was really hard to pin down, because when you think about it, I mean, nobody's 100% certain of anything. We just have our best possible interpretation of events. So I don't know, do you have any kind of thoughts on, like, how much can you truly know? Like, how do we arrive at essentially knowledge? How do we arrive at what we can say is definitively true? Or do we always have to quantify things as, you know, because I have a hard time saying that I'm ever 100% certain about anything, because it just seems like, well, I can't, if I get pressed on it far enough, I have to just say, well, because I read that, or,
yeah,
you know.
I don't really buy into the idea that you can really know something for an absolute. It's very hard. It's like the idea of perfection. Everybody's like, strive to be perfect, or, you know, have a perfect day, or, you know, that. That concept of perfection doesn't exist. So I don't think I correlate things to that in the way that you can't be for sure what the answer is to something, because we don't know what the answer is to anything. Not really. We only know as much as we know about what we've studied, or how far we've taken the research on something, or even to our own belief, like the amount of we question our own beliefs and ideas. Like, we believe them to the extent that we've evaluated them to be true for ourselves. But collectively, like, as a whole, how it applies across, you know, the entirety of humanity and existence, like, how can you know what's true when we only know a fraction of what exists?
Yeah, and that's what I think is so interesting, is that if you push things far enough, you know, you can be empirical and you can measure certain things and certain outcomes and have a relation there and a theory that goes along with what connects those. But any good science is continually updating and continually changing. So definitions of things change to fit new parameters of new experiments. So I think the most definitive thing you can say is, as of right now, I know this. But even then, I it's hard to say, you know, I know, like, how you arrive at knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of goes back to the idea of, you know, like, well, what is higher education's kind of purpose? Because I know you and I have both spent a decent amount of time in school at this point, and, you know, is the knowledge you gain from watching, you know, mini history lectures on YouTube any different than the knowledge you'd gain? So does it matter how you arrive at your knowledge? So if you have, you know, vast amounts of practical experience but haven't read many books, or have read a lot of books but haven't done a lot of practical things, like, do you think it really matters, like, how you arrive at your knowledge? Like, do you feel like there are certain environments that, or certain ways of doing things that are truly better, or do you think that we've just kind of put this sense of, like, professionalism into certain areas where you're saying, okay, well, if you learned it here, then it counts, but if you're just self-educated from reading a book or doing a thing and not in a formal setting, do you feel like those kind of are equitable? Like, how do you... Do you feel like there's different ways to arrive at knowledge and that some are better than others, or are they all the same?
Well, it matters in some cases, and in others it doesn't. When it comes to, like, written information, then it's kind of the same whether you're getting it in a classroom or you're reading it on your own. In fact, a lot of time, it's almost like the teacher isn't necessary. Like, you could learn the same things that you'd be learning on your own if you just had whatever layout that they gave you to begin with, right? And that's what a lot of online classes are, is the teacher says, here, read these chapters, take this quiz online, and then post in this discussion post, which I think are... discussion posts are garbage.
It's like, the worst.
I can barely get my friends to text me back, and then you want me to have a discussion online with strangers about stuff that half of them aren't interested anyway. Yeah. So anyway, that's a side rant. But no, because a lot of the time the teacher is there to maybe just give you some feedback, and that's about it. Like, most of the time you're acquiring the knowledge, you're reading the information, and you're processing it and then spitting it back out in whatever form that they wanted you to display it in, as a presentation, as a report. So in that aspect, I don't think that there's not really a difference between watching YouTube videos. If you were watching videos on YouTube that you were still watching in a class because they're linked to YouTube, then you'd essentially be doing the same thing. And the time where I think it makes a difference is when you're learning something that is like a skill. Mm. Like, you can watch carpentry videos and you can watch videos on how to fix a vehicle and things like that, but the practical application of it actually matters too. So while you may not learn it as fast as you would in a classroom, you can still do it through YouTube and videos. You just won't be certified because there wasn't an instructor watching you. You know, so that's... I think as long as the source of information that you're learning from is a good source, and that's something else to evaluate and talk about, is like, what sources of information should be valid and which ones aren't. Like, Wikipedia, why can't you cite Wikipedia? Because anybody can edit Wikipedia. Yeah, but then anybody can write an article, then it has to be peer reviewed, right? But those people, they all studied something of the similar nature, and then they're saying, yeah, this guy's paper sounds legit
because it sounds like something I've written.
Because it sounds like something I'd written. Yeah, exactly. So I mean, the whole system's kind of balances on this idea of paperwork. Paperwork is what separates us from the animals, right? So
bureaucracy.
So it's like, we place an emphasis and value on a piece of paper saying that we have been given the knowledge to do this thing or be an expert at this thing, as opposed to sometimes when we have our own hobbies and things that interest us individually, we study just as hard to learn those things, and we want to know just as much about those things as we would as if we were taking a college course. And the sources of information are just as valid, they're just not put together in a curriculum in a specific way.
Yeah, so you kind of get this like freestyle a la carte education, and I feel like, you know, with the exception of obviously like the mandatory USAW seminars and then other, you know, seminars you can take with coaches, almost everything in weightlifting education is this kind of self-guided, I heard about this book that I need to get, or I heard an interview with this guy on a podcast, or you're kind of sifting through all of this information. And what's so hard is that, just like with everything, with the exception of, I guess, you know, really rigid academic systems where nothing outside of the conventional ideology makes it through peer review, you know, sorting through conflicting information. Because how many times have you read two articles by two different coaches that are both very successful that are not in agreement with each other at all? About whether that's, you know, what average intensity to train with, or the usefulness of certain exercises, or even just the way you describe the pull. And I think that, you know, keeping in mind while you are kind of trying to do any sort of self-education, if it's about, you know, history or anything else, do you think it's a red flag if you avoid information that you don't agree with? Like, do you think it's important to, like, seek out things that you don't believe, but to read and understand their argument?
Oh, yeah,
like,
absolutely.
If you intuitively, like, you're like, oh, I don't really think that's true, but that means that if you have an area that you instinctually, like, think, oh, that's probably not true, that sounds like, you know, a bunch of baloney.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like if you have that gut reaction to, like, push that off, you need to spend some time in that area. Because if you feel like you're personally being attacked by an idea, that's an idea you're scared of, and you need to figure out why. You know, like, I feel like avoiding information that conflicts with the way you currently think about things is a common thing. Do you feel like that? Like, people tend to, like, try to put themselves... It's the idea of, like, that bubble, right?
Yeah, it's like confirmation bias.
Yeah.
You know, you like the things that agree with the way you already think, or agree with the way you think that they should be. And when you only have that viewpoint, like, it makes it to where your viewpoint is the only one that matters, and that's the only one that's correct. And when you don't allow other things and ideas to challenge your point of view, then you get this narrow mindset, and that growth doesn't take place in those mindsets. Because if you can't let something challenge your ideas, then how valid are they to begin with? Because if you don't have any outside information to compare it against and say, well, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe what I thought about it wasn't, I'm not 100% sure anymore. Instead of being able to do that, people are just like, well, nope, my opinion's right, that one's wrong, and that's the way it is. And I think that's not a very healthy way, and it's an immature way to kind of go about things. Because it's like when you see little kids arguing, right? It's like, no, my daddy's better than your daddy. And it's like, no, my daddy's better than your daddy. And so they'll go back and forth, and it's like, well, that's an egocentric point of view. So if you're holding on to an idea and you don't ever let anything challenge it, that's basically like saying, well, no, my daddy can beat up your daddy and you can't tell me otherwise. That's to me, that's what it's the equivalent of. And if you have an idea about, like, weightlifting, and you say, well, you know, let's take gymnastics, the pull-up, you're pulling yourself towards the bar, right? Pulling up. And then a push-up, you're pushing yourself away from the ground. So why do we call a pull from the ground a pull instead of a push? Because we are pushing the weight away from the ground and then pulling ourselves back toward the bar, toward the ground. Which is an opposite way of thinking about it, right?
And I actually happen to really like the description of the first pull as being a push. I really like that. I feel like it makes sense,
yeah.
You know? But it's all about, you know, what's your frame of reference?
Right.
It's a push if you're talking about the extension of the knees. But it's also a pull at the same time because you're opening the hips. So you're using the front and the back of the body, but you want it to be a conjoined system. So to say that the lift off the ground is a pull with your back and hamstrings is correct,
mm-hmm.
but to say that it's a push with your quadriceps is also correct. So it's all frame of reference. So if you're,
makes sense, yeah.
You know, certain that it's a push, you're unwilling to see that two things simultaneously exist and differently describe one event that you're watching.
Right.
And certainty, you know, tends to create stagnation, I think.
Right.
But here's where this is about to get to a devil's advocate argument. Does that mean we have to listen to Louis Simmons?
So there might be outliers, right? In every case, there might be an outlier where maybe what they're saying has really no bearing on anything that you do. The thing is, like, Louis Simmons has been praised as the powerlifting community's, like, champion of producing strong men and women, right?
And he's very successful with track and field and some MMA.
Yeah, so his methods work, and they work in arenas that he's, you know, continued to develop athletes in. But I don't think that you can just apply everything to anything in a way. So a lot of the things that we think about and we do have multiple applications, like multiple, when it comes to mindset and the way you think about things and lifting and approaches and things like that, like those carry over to other parts of your life. But if you're talking about specific methodologies in building strength athletes, I think that there's a point where you say, no, we're not gonna really include that in what we're doing. Not that there's not value in it, but the amount of value that we get versus the amount of sifting through some of the BS that is in there, that isn't really anything I'm interested in doing at this time. Like, if you want to clean up some of the ideas and make them geared and test them on strength athletes, specifically in the weightlifting arena, then maybe, yeah, like, we'll talk about it then. But if you just want to say, well, your method works for everybody, let's throw bands and chains on everything and do everything that way.
Well, that's an example of his certainty.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's just like, maybe he's a little bit overconfident in his ability to transfer all those things to other strength sports.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that on the other hand, though, there's also the other side where maybe we're too certain to throw out everything that he says, because I feel like, yeah, snatching with bands is ridiculous and probably just, one, hard to facilitate setting up, and two, potentially pretty dangerous. But the idea of building work capacity in the accessory movements could be a really good idea, because if you're so easily fatigued in your overhead position that you can make a few good reps but you get tired and start missing, doing some higher rep endurance work, or, you know, we use exercises, the back extension and the glute ham raise are things that he rambles about, and I do mean ramble, at nauseam, you know? So there is kind of like, if you say everything he says is wrong, you're missing out on a couple of important keys of, hey, that's a good way to strengthen your hamstrings.
Right.
But if you take him at his word and do everything, you're probably going to be wasting your time on some arenas. So I think you have to have that, you know, skepticism. But if you, and this is just kind of, maybe not even specifically to do with training, but just in general, if you're confronted by something that just strikes you as annoying and you're just, no, that's wrong, I feel like that's a thing that you really need to look at. Like, if you listen to nothing but, you know, NPR and MSNBC, you're missing what, you know, 50% of the population looks at as, you know, the truth in the world as it's happening. So I feel like if you're, you know, interested in politics or philosophy or, you know, just anything where there are diverging opinions, you have to make sure that you're consuming content from all sides. Like, I feel like even if you disagree with it, you have to be able to understand the argument. And what I really, like, are you familiar with the concept of, like, straw-manning somebody's argument?
Straw-manning.
Straw-manning would be if you were in a disagreement with somebody about whether it was a push or a pull in the lift off the ground. And a straw man is when you try to restate the other person's opinion in the worst possible light, where they're like, hey, I don't really think that it's a pull. And you say, so you don't think that you use the glute, like, I think we can describe it as a push rather than a pull. and you come back with, so you don't think the glutes do anything in the pull, you're crazy. Well, that's not what they said.
Right.
Right? So you're misrepresenting their argument to solidify yours. So you're, but the term that I've really liked and tried to bring to any sort of like discussion that I've been having with people that are these kind of touchy subjects is, before providing critique, I like the idea that Sam Harris put it as steel manning, where if you want to have a real like conversation with somebody, you need to understand their opinion so well that you can state it in the best possible light, where you first reiterate like, oh, so you think this is what's happening. You think that, you know, you're using primarily the posterior chain on this, and you need to be able to frame the argument to where they say, you know, yeah, that's exactly it, before providing your critique. Because if you come out with a straw man argument, you're just misrepresenting and you're not having a real discussion. You're just making arguments.
Right.
Versus really being able to represent other people's opinions. So, like, trying to understand why does Louis Simmons think this will work, and be able to represent that opinion and then provide your critique of it, rather than just immediately saying, well, that's crazy and it would never work.
Yeah, instead of discounting everything he's saying, because I know a lot of people are like, well, who's Louis Simmons? He hasn't produced any, you know, elite level Olympic weightlifters. Yeah, maybe not, but he's produced enough strength athletes to know something about what works in a general way. So maybe what some of the stuff he talks about as far as utilizing accessory work and accessory lifts and things like that might have good carryover. Might there be a better way to implement them? Sure. But I think in that way of looking at it, if you can understand where he's coming from and what he's trying to contribute, if he's trying to make a quick buck, that's one thing, right? But if he's actually trying to contribute a piece of knowledge and information that could be used to help progress athletes in the sport, why not? I mean, why not take a look into it? You might have to sift through some BS and look for some of the stuff that's applicable to what you're trying to accomplish with your athletes. But maybe that's better than just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, looking for common ground with people you disagree with, you know, like, if you, anybody you run into, and we're coming up on holiday season, finishing up with, you know, Christmas and New Year's and all that, and I'm sure that a big point of contention for lots of people is just talking with family members that you disagree with. You know, always looking for, you know, it's like, okay, well, what are the points that we, starting with what are the points we agree with, and then working through other things can really kind of help make that a less unpleasant situation. And, you know, being skeptical about the things you believe, I mean, it's essentially just being open-minded to new ideas, you know, where if you're always doing it the same way, you're not really growing.
Yeah.
And that, you know, applies as a coach or an athlete. Like, if you're just, this is how I snatch and I'm going to do it like this, and you're not every time you practice trying to make it a little smoother or a little bit better or a little bit faster, you know, it's, I think, you know, if you're not remaining skeptical of, is this the best snatch I could do? But you're saying, I'm the best already.
Yeah.
You know, you're probably going to be falling short, as opposed to if you, you know, are always looking for, what am I doing wrong, and questioning what you're doing.
I think a lot of the time, people, I think it has to do with comfort more than anything. They're comfortable with what they already know. And accepting a new idea or evaluating a new idea and integrating it or comparing it to their own is hard. And it's not comfortable all the time, because it challenges what you think and what you believe. And if something contradicts what you believe, just knowing that there's somebody else or something else saying that what you potentially think and believe it could be wrong, that's a hard thing to look at for some people. And it's just like food, right? How many people do you know, they go to the same restaurant, they order the same thing, and they never deviate from that stuff? That's what they're comfortable with. They know what they like. They know they're gonna like it. So they just keep going there. They keep ordering the same thing. But then there's this variety of other things on the menu and other places to eat, other types of food to eat that they never experienced, just because they're just afraid of, they might end up with something that they didn't like. And you're going to. You're gonna come across ideas. You're gonna come across food. You're gonna come across training methodologies that don't sit well with you, that you don't like, and that's fine. But at least you know you don't like them, instead of just thinking that yours is the best.
Yeah, I feel like that's, you know, one of the pitfalls when people, like, kind of colloquially use skepticism is they think of skepticism as being critical of ideas that you don't agree with. But no, I think you really need to be critical of ideas that you do believe.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, evaluate, like, why do I think that's true? And do I have any reason to think that? You know, and that kind of comes back to the, you know, where we started this discussion, where, so, some ways of gathering information, we won't call it knowledge or truth, but we'll call it gathering information, would be, you know, empirical stuff. You know, we measured this, or I read a study that looked at average loading intensity, and so this is the average loading intensity that's best for producing results, or this is the, you know, framework of how the world is, or whatever it is that you're looking at. You know, you kind of end up with, you know, this measurable stuff where you're really kind of breaking it down and saying, okay, well, this is this, this is this. And that's one way that you can arrive at, you know, something resembling knowledge or truth. But then there's the other idea that, do you think you can arrive at the truth through rationality, where just by thinking about things, can you arrive at a truth without having a measurement? Can there be something internal that, through your thought process and doing that, you know, challenging, refining your idea, challenging your own idea, refining your idea, do you think that we can really arrive at knowledge internally by being logical and rational and thinking, or do we need empirical data to know what's true?
That's a tough one.
Yeah, because it's kind of, you know, these are essentially like the two big, you know, early schools of philosophy, whereas there's, you know, empiricists and rationalists.
Right.
And it's really kind of interesting to think about, because there are some things that, you know, you arrive at not because you've gone out and specifically measured them, but, you know, we all have ideas that we've arrived at through personal experience and reflection. But can you say that something you arrived at just through logic is true?
It depends, I guess. So let's take color, for example.
That's a great example.
We don't all see color in the same way. Without an outside measurement of what the true color of something is, based on light and, you know, the amount of light it reflects and the amount of light it absorbs, there's no way of knowing exactly how close my red is to your red. Like, the color of red that you see might not be the exact same one that I see. That's why computers have a standardized subset of colors in swatches and things like that that make them look and appear the same way on a screen. But in reality, outside of the computer, the way our eyes perceive shades of color are different. That's why some people are colorblind. Some people, you know, have very high sensitivities to colors as well. So we arrive at the decision of saying this is red, and then we lump all these reds into one red. right?
Yeah.
But there's many variations of red. There's different shades and tints and hues and things like that. So to say reasonably to ourselves that we've arrived at an idea and this is true is to an extent true, because it's true for us. It's true from our perception, from our point of view. But from somebody else's point of view, that might not be the same shade of red that I see. But it is red, nonetheless. So while it might be close to say that 100%, like, this is true, is very difficult to do.
Well, and so that you know, what I really like about the color, you know, way that you're using that to discuss this is that while one person's colorblind and one person is not, red is the way that our brains process data. But the raw data itself is just wavelength.
Right.
Right? And we can look at, okay, here's the spectrum of wavelength that produces what we have come up with a construct to call red. But a person who's colorblind, it's not that they don't see that wavelength, it's just that it's not processed to be different than the wavelength that is green. So it's, they're getting the same data, it's just the processing is different.
Mm.
And that's kind of the idea that, you know, how much can we, you know, really rely on our sensory things when they can be so different and tricked. Like, if you fall asleep on your arm and your hand goes numb and you touch something, you can't feel it, but you know that you're touching something because you can see yourself doing it. But if you were just to trust the sensory perception, you would say, I'm not touching anything, or my hand has a bunch of needles in it. But that's not the true state of your hand.
Right.
So I think that, you know, like, we can't even, you know, be sure that what we see in the world is just kind of how our brains have evolved to process information to keep us alive. And, you know, we don't see ultraviolet. We don't see, you know, plenty of other wavelengths of radiation. We just see the ones that were useful for finding food and not getting killed. But that means that there might be, you know, very different ways that reality looks than how our senses perceive them. So I think that that's part of the argument that, you know, you have to arrive at truth through the only thing you are certain of, which is your own consciousness and your own thinking. Because if you can't trust your senses, then how can you trust your measurements?
Yeah. Well, and you've heard stories of people that have gotten amputations or something happens to a limb and they can still feel their fingers.
Yeah.
They can still perceive that their fingers are moving or could brush up against something, even though the limb's gone. It's called like a phantom limb. So there's also been experiments done where they'll be doing something and you can watch them on your hand, right, manipulating something like with an object or brushing a feather against it. They move your hand out of the way and then put a fake hand and do the same thing and you can still feel it.
Yeah, that's a really crazy one. There's like a double mirror,
right,
where it looks like a continuation of your arm, but they're actually touching a like prosthetic,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
And people report feeling the sensation because they can see it. So I think there's a lot of kind of weird, you know, if you take the skepticism, you know, to its furthest degree, where I will say that this is where skepticism might cease to be practical.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, you can go as far as doubting that other people exist or that you're here at all or you're, you know, having a vivid waking dream like the terrible end of a movie where it's just a crazy movie and then somebody just wakes up and goes, well, that was crazy. But, like, you know, so you can take that, you know, skeptical view of the universe to be like, well, maybe I'm the only person here because I don't know the contents of your mind. I just know that I have one. And, I don't know, these are not particularly useful things on a day-to-day, but, you know, keeping in mind that you might not even be correct about anything being, you know, real in any, like, sense. I think having that kind of bigger skepticism, because of course you have to operate like there is reality. You just can't prove it.
Right.
And you can measure things to try to prove it, but something could always be wrong. But I think that you have to operate, of course, like things are real and that what you're doing kind of matters. But keeping that kind of big level skepticism can make you better able to question your own beliefs and be more open to other ideas and, you know, on the other side of being open to new ideas, not buying every new thing you're told hook, line, and sinker, you know? And I think that within sport or coaching or just generally, you know, trying to live the best life that you can, having a certain degree of uncertainty, I think, is like the best way to approach. Because you'll never be caught in a loop or caught in a rut if you're constantly questioning and changing your opinions based on new inputs, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So we may or may not really be getting into a plane, but we're going to operate under the assumption that this plane will take us to a place called Milwaukee. That right now, I've never been there.
I've never been there.
As far as we know, Milwaukee might not exist until we arrive there.
it's like the loading screen for a video game.
Yep.
Like the flight is the loading screen, and then you get to the new place, and it's like this area that's just been constructed for your small time there.
Yeah, it's a flight simulator that like freezes for a second. You know,
and then all the new of a sudden area. We're there. Yeah, and then you're in the new area and you get to explore. Oh, man. All right, well, we have a lot to going on this week. We're going to head out to Milwaukee, watch some lifting, hopefully get some of our lifters some more experience on the national level stage, and come back with some more stuff to talk about as far as, like, weightlifting goes, but as well as, you know, maybe some of the weird, interesting things we come across while we're over there. So stay tuned. Next week we will be back, and probably the week after. I don't know about doing a podcast while we're out there, but
yeah, we'll see if we can block out an hour Saturday afternoon. But if something comes up, we'll be back week after next, and we'll do it all over again, guys. Have a good one.
All right, y'all. Happy lifting.